Charlie.
4341-790, Brass Stacks, the Thursday edition. Good afternoon. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Mr. Johnson.
Yes, sir.
Yes, the lady before this one I just called. Mm-hmm. I was trying to get you for the longest while, but I couldn't get you. So
Because yes. All the lines are blank from 12:30.
On other days I was trying to get you. Okay. I couldn't get you. Yeah. What the lady said about Paragon, it is so much true. I myself was quarantined up there.
Okay.
You know, I'm one of the crew members that came in off the ship. We were on the ship and we came in on the day and they spread us down, our luggage, everything, gave us masks, the whole works they did, you know. And we went into quarantine and when we got there, it was only one guy there in a big building by himself. One guy. And this guy was so happy to see us. You hear what I tell you? He said he could not sleep. He had many sleepless nights because he was there all alone. And when we joined him, it was like a dream come true. He was so happy to have people to talk to, you see? And it was a very wonderful experience. The food was great. You see, people complain about the food was cool. Look, people have to understand, the more people that you bring to the place is obviously the more food you will have to distribute. And the food doesn't come from right in the building. They have to bring it down in one of the vans from up top and bring it down to us for the nurses to distribute it to everybody, you see? So people want, they're not in a hotel. They're not in a five-star hotel. They have to understand life. The circumstances does not allow you to get caviar and shrimp and that kind of stuff. No, it doesn't allow that. You have to be thankful for what you have and deal with the situation.
You were there for 2 weeks?
Yes, I was there for 2 weeks. Now, I've been home for, at the end of this week, I'll be home for 2 weeks now.
Okay.
So I came over a week and a half.
Okay.
About a week and a half.
I want to back you up a little bit here too, because you're the second, only the second person I've spoken to who's actually been quarantined and here. And also you've added the fact that you were on the ship.
Right.
What's the experience like being on the ship? Because it seems from reading the reports that I've read, ships seem to have been, I don't know, the bomb, the incendiary device in this whole thing, because there's still ships, not only in our harbor, but across the harbors in the world, Miami, in somewhere in the east, far east as well, with thousands of people just going around in circles. What was the feeling like on the ship when you were there?
Well, the feeling for me, because every ship was different.
Different. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because different companies operate differently.
Right.
The company I was on, it was very, for us, we were COVID-free. We had no cases for the time that I was there.
Okay.
And it was very, very relaxing for me as an entertainer. I'm an entertainer. So for me, I had no problems because I learned music. Program music, practice.
Right.
That was my daily routine. So I didn't have time for all of that. You see, it would affect people. Once people look, these people have, you have to understand, there are different cultures: Caribbean, European, Asian. They're all different cultures. So you'll get some person from Asia who's a smoker,
right,
and they like to go to the crew bar and have a drink.
Right.
Now when you take that away from them, you see, it's
not happy.
Exactly. It's taken away what they love to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
What they love to do. So they find themselves in a kind of a serious situation where it's like, oh, well, I can't. Because they're not allowed to smoke in the cabin.
In the cabin. Okay.
That's a no-no. You cannot smoke in the cabin.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to have parties in the cabin either. So that was taken away from them, right?
Playing cards and gambling?
No, that too you can't do. You can't none of that either.
Okay.
So what the companies did, they take a lot of the crew from downstairs in the cabins with no windows and put them in the guest balconies after they were all sanitized properly. Put them in the guest, give them balconies that they can get some fresh air.
Right.
So a lot of the crew, you take 1,000 crew and put on a ship that carries 3,000 passengers, you have room for everybody.
Who treated, who took care of your rooms and changed linen and that kind of thing?
Yes, Well, what they do, they obviously they have room stewards, they have cooks okay. on board,
mm-hmm.
what we call essential service on board the ship also.
Right.
So they will come and change your linen, sanitize, mm-hmm. do all that stuff for you. You had to do none of that.
Okay.
You were being pampered while you were being in quarantine.
So you were right? being a guest and a worker at the same time?
You were being a guest at work at the same time.
Okay.
And then what they would do, they would allow break times where people, you can still go out and get fresh air.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, show a movie on the cinema, but obviously you have to keep your distance.
Apart, depending on and the size of the cinema, of course, because I know
yeah,
some have
no,
500 seats, some have more.
No, this is outdoor cinema.
Oh, okay.
Outdoor on the
by
pool deck.
The pool deck.
So okay. what they will right. do, they will remove the seating.
Mm-hmm.
They space the seating. Right. So they had enough seating there that you had no choice but to keep your distance.
Distance,
gotcha. Right, you see? No, so it was... It was a very, very good experience. I wouldn't say a bad, it was a good experience to me, that something like this could cause people to come together and realize, look, we are all in this together. Seriously.
I want to ask you another question, because again, as I said, I've been reading a lot on this.
Right.
And I'm glad you said you were an entertainer, because that pigeonholed something else I read. There was a report in the Trinidad Guardian with a Trinidadian who was also, or is also, an entertainer. And he wanted to get home to Trinidad. He was complaining that the Trinidad government wouldn't let him come back. But one of the things he said that struck me, because I make notes when I go along, was that there were suicides and people being driven close to suicide because of being adrift on these ships.
Right.
Did you have any of that kind of experience where people were getting hopeless and saying, you know, we're going round and round? I know you said there are different companies doing different things, but did you see or feel that kind of despair with the ship you were on?
No. And the same Trinidadian guy, we were on the same ship together.
Okay. Right.
We talked. He's also an entertainer also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I know him personally, yes.
Okay.
We were on the same ship together. But you see what happened? He was speaking from people from other ships
mm-hmm.
that had committed suicide,
mm-hmm.
right? People from other companies. I mean, one or two from our company did do that too. But the reason for that, people have to understand. You see, once you tell people that they're going home, and the CDC is the one that makes these decisions. They'll tell the cruise ship, okay, we allow you to bring home 300 Filipinos to fly home tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all packed and ready to go. And on the day when the ship is supposed to dock, the CDC changes their mind.
I say no.
And says, you can't come now. So then you're back at square one.
Mm-hmm.
So it had nothing to do with the ship. The captain has nothing to do with that. He has to obey orders from the office,
mm-hmm.
the lands on shoreside,
mm-hmm.
and they have to communicate with the CDC.
Okay.
So once the CDC changed their mind, there ain't nothing nobody can do about it. They are the ones in control.
Mm-hmm.
They can tell you tomorrow, okay, you're leaving tomorrow. And then tomorrow something come up, they say, you can't leave tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So they keep changing it all the time. So some crew members got so frustrated with that, you know, that they could not take it. They just could not take it. You know, it was just one of those things where people, this is where you need your friends now around you, people that see you. You know, when they tell you, see something, say something.
Mm-hmm.
You see some person on the deck looking out as though they're thinking.
They're lost.
Have a conversation with them at a distance and find out what's going on with them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll be surprised to hear some of the things that people tell you. You know,
play them a song and tell them, come and sing with me.
Exactly. You understand? Even things like that, right?
Yeah.
But you see, people are feeling that the ships were the ones. People, the crew members, the passengers are the ones that bring the crew members.
Yeah.
You see, we were there waiting for them. They bring it on. We didn't go anywhere to bring it on board. They're the ones that bring it on, the passengers. So we had to deal with it. And not only that, what the crew members did also, you can imagine a ship with over 1,000 crew. You had to sanitize the ship. Every single crew member, you had to go and sanitize. It was like a daily job. You understand what I mean?
Everything.
In the morning,
mm-hmm.
in the evening. And you had to sanitize the ship with all the spraying down, your mask, your gloves, you had to do a complete sanitize of the ship. So they're not just there relaxing. They are trying to protect themselves also, you see?
I'm going to ask you this, because that's one of the things that what you've just brought out is one of the things I want to use a Brass Tack Sunday to focus on. And that's how we go back to work during COVID and post-COVID. Do you want to return to work? Will you return to work?
At this point right now,
mm-hmm.
I won't want to go because it's a lot of things are happening right now at this present time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say another 6 months down the road, 7 months
mm-hmm.
or so, probably yes.
Okay.
Right? Because it's my job.
Right. Do you have enough to tide you through 6 months?
Pardon me?
Do you have enough to tide you through the 6 months? Were you still being paid during the time you were locked down on your ship?
They paid you to a certain time. Mm-hmm. After a certain time, they cut your pay.
Okay.
Because then it's obviously they have to feed you. They have to take care of you. And all of that is a cost for them also.
Mm-hmm.
While you're on board, they have to do all these things for you. They have to
feed you and
exactly.
change linen and that
exactly.
type of thing.
Exactly. So all of that comes with a cost, you see? So what they did, they might cut your pay at a certain time,
right.
but they still feed you for free.
Okay.
You still eat for free. Mm-hmm. You're not paying for that.
Mm-hmm.
They still feed you. You take your showers, you're regular. You're just like in a hotel, but a different situation.
A different situation. A little more restrictive.
A little more restricted, exactly.
Yeah.
You just have to know how to deal with the whole situation. Tell yourself, look, this is what it is. It doesn't matter how it got here, who bring it here, it's here with us.
Right.
We have to deal with it as a family,
mm-hmm.
as a family.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's how we have to deal with it. They take your temperatures twice, three times a day, you know, and I'll tell you, you miss those temperature checks, you are in deep trouble.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
These captains was very, very, very strict with that kind of guideline. You miss that. And they had people from the CDC on board some of the ships monitoring the situation too,
yeah.
to make sure that you are doing the right protocol and stuff like that, right?
Helped you appreciate your team a little more, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. You see? So, and even at Paragon,
mm-hmm.
when we got to Paragon and we got off a ship and we come in ashore,
mm-hmm.
they bring us over on lifeboat, on one of the lifeboats,
because
the ship couldn't dock, because
right.
another ship was there dock, and we come over on the lifeboat, spray down, sanitize, passport, spray down, sanitize, bam, bam, luggage on one of those small transport board buses,
mm-hmm.
and took us straight to Paragon. It was only five of us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the space
in the bus
to separate ourselves from one another, you see? And Paragon, they were fantastic up there. The nurses, they were wonderful. Everybody come talk to you every day. Good morning. How you doing? Any problems? You want towels? You want soap? You want soap powder? You want to wash your clothes? Whatever you want, just let us know. And they bring it. You want alcohol? Bring all that stuff they give you. It was so nice, and I'll tell this, Mr. Johnson, that there was five musicians up there,
mm-hmm.
five musicians up there, and one of our local well-known name musicians was up there also.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of our quarantine, Mr. Johnson, we got all of the nurses together and everybody, and we did a half-hour show for them.
Sir, from the bottom of my heart, I thank you. This is so uplifting, sir.
You understand? It was so fantastic that we enjoyed it. We gave them a show, and they all enjoyed it. Obviously, we had our social distancing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big room,
mm-hmm.
and we gave them a show, and it was fantastic, and they all loved it. You understand? But they told us, we don't want to see you back up here.
That was a loving send-off, sir.
That was
your mother saying, don't let me beat you again.
Exactly. It was wonderful. So people who have to go to Paragon, don't be afraid. You'll be well taken care of. And I'll tell you, Mr. Johnson, the fresh air up there is unbelievable, man. Unbelievable, man.
Sir, I thank you. I really do thank you because your experience, sir, is a positive one. I am sure the picture you've painted is one that I will remember, and I hope those listening remember it as well. And to me, the most important part of your story is the fact that you guys said thank you in the best way you know how. I always say this, and sir, and I can say this to you. You've really touched a nerve here with me, and a good nerve. I will say this to you, sir. I have said to people all the time, there is one Christmas carol that puts me in the spirit of Christmas. It's called The Little Drummer Boy. And the reason why The Little Drummer Boy strikes me so much is because here's a little boy who the only talent he had was beating a drum. And when he was called to meet the king, he said, can I play for you? Because that's all I could do. And the king smiled, and that was all he took from it. Your talent is a musician. There are people who could do other things. There are people who could paint. There are people who could draw. There are people who could build houses. Your talent is a musician. And you guys thought that the best way you could say thank you to people who took care of you is to share your talent freely with them. So, and that is a lesson that my people need to hear and hear over and over again. Sir, I thank you. I thank you. I thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Be of good health and take care, sir.
Yeah, right away, sir.
And may your entertainment enlighten and lift more lives when you return to work.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Good call, sir. Thank you very much. Brass Tacks, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Johnson.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. As a farmer, as a person who used to go to sea as well, I can understand what that gentleman just said when you're on a ship for so many days and you can't do anything. In 1974, I was on a ship and we were towed from Cape Town in South Africa to Bahrain in the Persian Gulf. And it took us about 40-something days to get there being towed. And if you look up, it's blue. If you look down, it's blue. Left, right, it's blue. 40-something days. And you couldn't want nothing more frustrating than that. So I understand quite clearly what the gentleman is saying. But let me just say this to you, though. Coming home from that same ship I just mentioned to you in Bahrain in 1974, when we got to Barbados, having gone to Europe and some of the Caribbean islands, when we got here, we came on BOAC. In those days, it was BOAC and not BA.
Yeah, British Overseas Airways Corporation, yep.
Exactly. And when I got to the airport, the immigration officer, and what I tell you is in response to something that you said earlier. The people can send you back to your last port of call if the sword is there, but I have to have a good reason to do so. Yeah. When I got at Stewart International Airport, the picture in my passport, they look nothing like me in person, because the picture in my passport had me with a little piece of beard. I learned piece of moustache. And the picture
they should arrest you for having somebody else's passport.
and the person that was standing in front of the immigration officer, they looked like Robinson Crusoe with a lot of beard.
Listen, I remember seeing a joke once, right? I didn't want to interrupt you, but I remember seeing a joke once that said, if you look at your passport picture, you're too sick to travel. So they should have quarantined.
You know?
So, I could imagine. After that time at sea, I know what some of my relatives look like, and they only smell of salt water, too.
Yeah. But the fellow that caught me, right, and he said to me, this person in the picture and you is not the same person. And the man looking at the picture looking at me. And then, you know what he tell me? He tell me, I can go to St. Bart to Heathrow. I said, well, sir, it really don't matter to me. I would get a flight back to London and a flight back to Barbados. And when they come back, the government got a lot to give me some money. So he called his supervisor. I know his supervisor told him, you're looking at the beard. But you don't look at the beard. You look at the person's eyes. The nose, the mouth, the forehead, the cheekbones. Them are things you look at and not the beard. And after further examination, the man said, oh, yeah, this is a little like you for true. And the supervisor tell me, tomorrow, you go into and get this here sorted out. Get a new picture in this passport.
Or get a haircut.
Now, even if I had a haircut, I still
you still don't look like it because you're... Yeah.
I was trying to get the ping pong put in the passport.
Mm-hmm.
But to your caller that called earlier that spoke about the port, he was correct in a sense, but he left out some information.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it changed to Barbados Port Authority, they had changed from port contractors, port department. The change from port department, port contractors, and cargo handlers to Barbados Port Authority. And then the change from Barbados Port Authority to Barbados Port Inc.
Right.
So that's the information you left over, cargo handlers and port department. But the managers now, it was Keefall before Peter Parker. I think it was Keefall before Peter Parker. But he's an old Star Wars too, so he know the port well.
I know that. I was just about to tell you from my conversations with him in the past, he seemed to have a particular attachment to that particular place, like you do.
Yeah, yeah.
You may have been in different places, but you seem to have been in and around the general area.
Yeah, I work in every area in the port. I work as a longshoreman, a stevedore. I work in marine. The last 23 years of my working life, I work in the signal station. But like I say, he was in port from a youngster too, early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So he will have he got a great knowledge of the port. But it's probably just an oversight on his part, not to have
mentioned those. But well, yeah. You know, the changes, I suppose, over the years, some have been comfortable with it, some have not. There have been changes to the operations, and I think all ports of entry, there are people who have gotten into public-private sector relationships. There are people who have openly said I think at one point, the only thing in Antigua Airport that wasn't run by the government of Antigua, that wasn't run by Alan Stanford was the departure tax. He wanted to run everything else, including the runways. But anyhow, good to hear you, sir, and thank you very much. Brass Tacks, good afternoon.
Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
How are you?
I am all right, ma'am, and you?
I'm good, Dennis.
Why have you laughing like that? I have not heard you laughing like this. And you seem very happy today. Usually when you call, you sound serious and agitated. You had a good lunch.
No, I don't ever sound agitated. I might sound passionate, but...
Well, that's what it is.
It's a difference. Huh?
So when people tell me that I'm upset, I should say no. Okay.
No, you let them know you're not upset if you're not.
If you say so.
I want to say, though, that conversation with the entertainer was really nice. And it reinforced what I felt. I listened to persons describing the 33 who it, Trinidad and others who came in from Suriname, 33 who in Barbados, the Trinidadians, and went home, and the ones who were in Suriname, and a few of Barbadians who stayed at Paragon, speaking about the treatment they got with the nurses. And it reinforced in my mind that those nurses and doctors, and probably other ancillary staff too, they went obviously beyond, over and above, to make sure persons were well-treated. But I felt like it probably was a personal mission. You get the feeling that it was a personal mission for them to ensure that everybody went home alive. So I could imagine how those 7 deaths would have affected them earlier on, because you get the sense that they were trying so hard. And it's a consistent thing. I heard the same thing in Barbados. I heard the same description he was given also in Trinidad about the nurses who did everything, any little extra thing that would, you know, ensure that your stay was good. So I want to thank the nurses and the team, the COVID team, the doctors and nurses, because I believe I want to thank the police officers, ambulance drivers. There are others. We think only of nurses and doctors, but I'm sure there were other persons who played a part. I just, on the matter of COVID, I just wanted to address 2 things. I wanted to say that when they are assessing how they deal with the QEH and probably Health, Ministry of Health in general, they need to look again at the QEH, because I'm hearing from persons, elderly persons, I heard even on another radio station, and I've been hearing it on your station as well, the whole question of what took place during that lockdown with persons who had serious health complications and were not attended to. At the QEH, and they were met at the entrance by a nurse saying, well, we're not dealing with that here. You go to Winston Scott or go somewhere else to deal, whether it's diabetic, asthmatic, whatever. And I think that is one failing, in that I believe a medical doctor or a team should be there assessing persons. And I don't think the whole hospital should be a serious and lockdown. But remember, this is the first time we had COVID. So you give, you know, you make allowance for the fact that I think everybody was so scared when you look at Italy and New York, what was happening. We weren't sure what was going to happen here. But it seems as though they're still continuing this thing about not dealing with diabetics or persons not sure when they're going to have examination at the polyclinics and these other places, based on what I'm hearing. So I'm just saying that is an area they need to look at urgently. I know they're coming back on the stream, but they need to look at it, because I heard a lady this morning speaking about not having a foot dress, and she felt she was going to get gangrene because they kept pushing her back and giving her just dressing, and she kept asking them, could you please look at my foot? She's a bad diabetic. The other major issue I want to speak at...
Before you move off from that, let me say this. Before you move off from that, let me say this. One of the, I think one of the sad things about medical attention in particular is this. In the minds of anybody going to an institution for medical care, their situation is urgent and, you know, crucial. Let me put it that way, to them, health in particular. Far too often, it's that those who are medically trained are trained to quickly assess whether it is urgent, crucial, and, you know, make that determination. That interaction sometimes plays out in the worst possible way. Because what you may have is a medical attendant who is dealing with a gunshot wound, who's dealing with something else, and somebody comes and says, come and look at my foot. I fear I can get gangrene. And the reaction is, hold on. You know, you need to wait. And then the person gets agitated, and they both get agitated.
Yeah.
Some organizations try to keep, you know, them apart so that you don't have that. I have found that it is a difficult thing to manage. I have been in the hospital on more than one occasion where I've had to sometimes hear what's happening around me, and I can feel the tension. I have been there at times when, in intensive care, for example, where, and the nurses, they are, let me tell you, they're like the ones that are paragon that we're talking about. Those people who deal with those types of situations are special, special, special people. Where the nurses in intensive care kept coming and asking me, you all right? You're in pain? I keep telling them, why you don't go and check on somebody who's sick? There ain't nothing wrong with me, right?
Yeah.
And they're going, but no, you got this and you got that. And I say, look, I good. Just wind up my bed. I don't like lying down flat. And go and deal with people who need to be dealt with. But they came and they sat and they talked to you. The challenge we have is that in this COVID environment, in trying to make sure that you keep the area free from the virus while still dealing with people who, according to some of the reports I've read, have stayed away from the hospital because they too are afraid, and now they're getting to critical. It will take a special team in place working short times to try to not get the aggravation that's going to occur, because it will occur with people who are working under pressure for long periods. But hopefully we'll manage it.
I know that. I think some people may have stayed away because the notice went out that do not come at the QEH. Do not come. I think a lot of persons, I heard not only on the radio station, but other instances where persons, especially elderly persons, you recall the guy that was in the newspaper 2 weeks ago, his aunt was a nurse at the QEH, and he went in there, doctor-ordered tests, and how, you know, so I'm saying something, they need to look at the handling of, if this COVID resurface in a large way, they need to look at how they handle
other cases,
QEH and serious other illnesses. Yeah. But I think the soft skills and the, you know, talking to people, reassuring, because with sickness, I always, sometimes a bedside manner, it's for some people,
half of the way.
It is, yes,
half
more than
the way
even
to recovery.
The actual thing, you know.
Half
so
the way to recovery,
I think they need to look at that. And I always feel I have a real soft spot for the elderly because they built this country. So I think they need to look at that, because what I'm hearing out there, they're just giving them appointments and pushing them around. They need to really start working short, quickly, you know. The other thing is with the churches. That is another thing that I'm not. I saw Bishop Attlee saying, hell no, Sis Joe's. Sir Joe, an opposition leader, called for resistance to strict church guidelines. I think this is another thing. I don't know if Izizar came up with this along with other persons who they were. They talked to the church leaders, various church leaders, small and big. But some of these measures seem real extreme, and I agree with Bishop Joseph Attlee. You have been fined $50,000 or imprisonment for a year if you breach any of these regulations. And the thing is that it seems, as I said, when you compare it with other establishments, it seems to be discriminating against them in that you have to keep on air condition. You cannot keep on air condition. You must open windows. Mm-hmm. You have to get test every person that use a thermometer test. Yeah. Everybody temperature. Mm-hmm. So instead of then you have to you keep a register.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everybody that goes into the bank don't sign a register or go in credit union or wherever else. The air condition is within there. You know, no serving a communion, but they're disposable communion cups that you can use and you get rid of these little plastic cups. So I don't know, you come up in a line 6 feet apart and one person come and you serve them and they leave. So I am saying, and what it is, churches, small and large, because I spoke to someone, an elder in a church, and also a pastor, and they were saying that they are so confused and upset about it because it seems that they're not going to open the churches because the restrictions are so many, they're unsure about things, and they felt it's too extreme. And I really think that, you know, they say if you keep, you develop a habit after 3 weeks of doing the same thing all the time, I think eventually church membership might decline because persons who have stayed away so long, and especially the younger generation, not the older ones, might just decide, well, I can just watch it through the streaming because some churches offer that. And you don't know, that is a possibility. So I am just hoping that the government really deal with this quickly because...
But hold on a second. The length of time you stay in the bank is not the length of time you stay in a church. And they've asked that you also keep it down to an hour.
1 hour.
I saw that. No. The other problem is there have been cases, or two, I think, where a member of the church congregation, the one that was called Sanctuary in the City, where two members tested positive and the church actually gave a list of their membership. That helped with the tracing. There was a situation where one person went into a bank, they had to test everybody in the bank. I don't know how far the tracing went from there and how difficult or how easy it was. The challenge for managing this has been the gathering of people, the intermingling of people, and trying to keep them from mingling until we had the situation under control. That's why opportunities for people to mingle, sitting at bars, sitting in restaurants, going to places of worship, etc., and even funerals and weddings faced the heaviest hand, so to speak. A church gathering for people worshiping is a moment for unity, a moment for intermingling, interacting. I think it is alien to any church, mosque, temple that I've been to in the Caribbean for people to be distant, sitting one per pew and looking at the back of each other as though you're in segregated Southern America back in the 1960s. You sit together, sign a peace. There are people that I hug and kiss because I always wanted to hug and kiss them and wanted the opportunity to do it. In a church and get away with it too. I'm being funny or trying to be silly when I say this. But the reason, I think, is to try to ensure that when you loosen the grip for COVID, you don't do it too quickly. Now, how many churches you spoke to, what the reaction was, I don't know. I heard a caller to Brastack saying he wanted to hear the reaction from the People's Cathedral. And the moderator asked if that was his congregation. I figured it was because of the size, perhaps, of the People's Cathedral that you may have asked for that. Because there are some places where you can accommodate a larger number. I didn't hear anything from the Baptists either, or from the mosques, or from the temples. So there seems to be some religions that responded, and others have just remained very silent.
I know Muslims wear
face coverings, but...
I am only saying based on what I'm reading, what I've heard from persons, and there isn't a large number, pastor, another elder, and, you know, just things that you would refer. Mm-hmm. But I'm saying to you that, for me, the idea of persons, you have ushers in churches. So the idea of making sure they keep the physical distance can be reinforced by the ushers and monitored and managed by the ushers. So it will be difficult in terms of persons, the older persons understanding they have to stay and not go and hug, but the ushers are there to guide that. And
my problem is when you get to 25, when you're supposed to have 25, when you tell the 26th person, go back home or stay in the yard. That's the challenge I see.
I don't understand.
That's the challenge I see.
Is it opening? Is it 20, Dennis? I don't know. It's confusing. Oh, is it that the church will be open or is it still at the 20?
I don't think it's still at the 20. I will reread the last bulletin I got on it and see exactly what that figure is, because the last thing I remember hearing from the Attorney General is the square footage that you allow per person. And depending on the size of your church, when you divide that by the square foot per person, will determine the number of people that are allowed into the church at the time. That's the last I remember hearing. I will check the release on it to make sure that that's the correct thing. But that's the last I heard. Thanks for your contribution. 4341790. I think the measures are in place is a case of one making it bad for all. Had that church in Bridgetown not have 5 positive cases, which is considered a cluster, the measures would not be so stringent. I'm an elder in my local church. I'm in no hurry to get back there, says the WhatsApp. Brassax, good afternoon. The other one says, the Anglican Church is not willing to serve communion in disposable glasses. Hey, hello.
Hey, top of the day to you.
All right.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Good afternoon.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Good afternoon. Mr. Johnson, I would like, if I may, to raise 3 questions with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one, I think, goes back to somebody's putting out something, I think it was last week, Thursday, about the letterboxes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my understanding is that they've moved the date now from the 1st of June to the 1st of September.
September.
Mm-hmm. Right. But what concerned me was this business about social engineering as far as a postman is concerned. I I've done sociology at a university in England, and I never understood that a postman has anything about him called social engineering. And I think we are confusing the fact that you may meet your postman and say hello, or he may say hello, and think it is social engineering in that sense. I take a different view. The woman is doing a job of work, and the fact that he or she brings letters and puts in your letterbox is beside the point. But as far as letterboxes are concerned, and I speak as someone who should know because my wife worked at the post office, I happen to know that for some years, postmen have been complaining about being bitten by dogs, being run by dogs, even sometimes being run by humans, and that they wanted a letterbox in which to deposit the letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really see what is so grand about this person asking for the idea of putting letterboxes to be abolished altogether. That, to me, is an asinine idea, and I think people should desist from the subject if they don't know what they're talking about.
So the challenge, I think, it wasn't Thursday, because if it was Thursday, the person would have been talking to me. I think if I was producing the day, so I remember the call. The challenge that I saw from the argument, and one that you haven't touched, that I add to it, is this. Once upon a time, we had chattel houses stretched out nicely, and you'd go from house to house to house on your bicycle or with your bag over your shoulder. If you have the grotto, if you have the London-born towers, if you have Country Park towers, and the other high-rise buildings that have come up in Barbados, to walk up the stairs and down the stairs and push a letter under each of the doors is time-consuming. If you have a room secure downstairs where there are 30 or 40 letterboxes and postman simply comes onto the ground floor in that area and puts all the mail in the respective boxes and then leaves, he gets to his job a lot faster. And I think one has to think of those places when you consider having a postal worker, let me use that because they're females as well, yeah, go up and down stairs to 40 different apartments in a high-rise building. And that's something that wasn't around, I don't think, in great numbers in 1965 or 66 or 70 even.
Right. Well, I've had a glance at the regulation that they're bringing out.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows for a person's front door to be used as the mailbox.
Yeah, with a slot, yeah. Mm-hmm.
With a slot in it.
Mm-hmm.
And which is, by the way, the custom in England. Nearly every home, the front door has a slot for the mail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that is so, I don't see how it will get away from walking up all those stairs as you suggest, although I understand the point you're making.
So, which is why I thought of those. When I heard about, you know, put a slot in the door, I thought about London Bourne Towers and Country Park Towers and all these towers that we're building.
Yes, I understand the point that you made.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let me move on to my next point.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening earlier to the program and someone messaged Brastad and suggested that Bajans who are supposed to be sent back to Barbados or who are coming back to Barbados should go back from where they came.
Yes.
Now, that funny enough, that doesn't surprise me too much if the person who made that call was in fact a Barbadian. Now, we here have a very bad habit of calling Barbadians who return home returning nationals. Now, let me just make this point. I returned to Barbados in 1993 and didn't waste much time in getting involved at government level, but mind you, in asking for some things to be changed, because it was then the custom to get 40% discounted from any four-year-old or older car that you brought in from abroad. And thankfully, the then government, which I think was the UNASA government, changed the laws on that matter and actually allows anyone who has lived abroad for 10 years or more to bring in a car and pay no duty on it whatsoever. That too had to be changed because it had allowed anybody. So if a household had four people who had each left for 10 years or more, they could have brought in four cars. And that became a problem in that some people were bringing in the cars and selling them before the three-year period was up.
Correct.
And trying to make money off selling cars at that level. And therefore, it now stands that only one member per household can do it. Full stop.
Yeah, I remember
which I think is a brilliant idea.
I remember that one, yeah.
Right. Now, we never gave away our nationality when we were living abroad. At least I didn't. I was a Bajan in London, as I am now here in Barbados. And people have to understand, because I think it is a lapse of understanding here. When an American or an Englishman who has lived in Barbados for 30 years returns home, we gladly say, oh, the Yankee has gone back. That's the worst we say about them. or we will say the Englishman has gone back home.
But you know somehow, why, right? You know why, right, sir, right?
Somehow, the Bajan is now a returning national. I don't know that he's given away his nationality at any time. And I'm here as proof. I have two nationalities by law. But I am proud to be a Bajan. And I have never given away my Bajan nationality to anyone. So I am offended, literally offended, if I'm called a returning national. Because, yes, I have returned as a national, but I'm not a returning national. I want that to be made clear. I hope you...
I get it. The thing is, though, and this is, I think, one of the sad realities of persons who have lived and worked overseas and have returned to their place of birth and struggle a little bit sometimes to reintegrate themselves into society. They're paying the price for others who have either returned and found fault with everything and criticized this backward place, come back here and, you know, nothing has improved since I left. I can't get this, I can't get that, and became complainers. And those who have a strong sense of national pride kicked back against it. Then there were others who felt that people came back. It's called human nature and jealousy and petty envies and that kind of thing, who latched onto the same thing you mentioned as part of your presentation, that they were coming back, bringing back new cars, bringing back these duty-free cars and selling them, and, you know, they were perhaps coming to show off on us. And unfortunately, those who came back and wanted to just reintegrate into the society become a part and parcel of the nation that they identify with, they felt a resistance, they felt pushback. And there were others who came with chips on their shoulders. And that, too, is a part of reintegrating into the society. There are people who, like myself, not born in Barbados, but who's been here off and on since 1962, prior to independence, I may add, and who returned to Barbados in 81 because I wanted to return, and who will spend my entire life here and will be told by some people, but you ain't no Bajan. And go back where you come from. And I usually smile at that and say I have no emotional or any other kind of connection to the other places I've lived. Most of the people I've known, they're either dead or missing or can't be found. Yes, I can go back and reintegrate myself into the society, but it would take me so much time to do it that at some point in your life you say, look, it doesn't matter anymore where I am, I'm just there. It is unfortunate that people like you who've come back and have tried to reintegrate into the society without causing the kind of friction that you may think you're causing, may do it simply because of the way you interact, the way you speak, the way you stand up for the things that you think need to be changed. Because there will be those who will be saying, why are you coming back from where you come from to tell me what to do? It's unfortunately a part of human life. The scenes we see playing out in other parts of the world, no different, where people who say the Poles are coming in here to take our jobs, the black people are coming in there to push us out of our neighborhoods, the Chinese are coming to take over Africa, the people in Tobago saying even the road signs in German now, these Germans buying out the place. That, sir, is human beings reacting to the changing environment that makes them uncomfortable. Sometimes it's their locals returning, sometimes it's people from abroad. It's what makes life challenging but interesting. I want to thank those who made today one of the more enjoyable days I've done down to brass tacks, especially the callers who called, who spoke about their COVID experiences. Most uplifting, most enlightening. Thank you, John, for taking me through what I anticipated to be a very challenging day, but we've done it successfully. And thank you for just listening and being a part of the Thursday edition of Down to Brass Tacks. For the team, I'm Dennis Johnson. Good afternoon.